Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Buenos dias. Muchas enchiladas. Welcome, everybody. Patrick Madrid here. Hour two of our three-hour extravaganza known as the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Back to the phones. Let's go to Christy in Jefferson City. I'm sorry, Jefferson, Wisconsin. Good morning, Christy.
Yes, good morning. Okay, Rick, my question. In the Gospel of John, the whole Eucharistic, this is my flesh, it's my true flesh. But then a few verses later, it speaks about how the flesh is of no avail. How do you explain that to a Protestant that wants to argue with you or debate or discuss? I don't want to say argue. Discuss that with you. How do you explain that then?
It comes up. It's one of those sort of stock arguments that is used. And usually by the time somebody gets to that argument, they're kind of flailing, grasping at something that will help deflect the power and the clear meaning of the text that Jesus is saying this literally. So when he says the flesh is of no avail, he's not referring to his own flesh. Because remember, he says, my flesh is real food. My blood is real drink. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up at the last day. For my flesh is food indeed, and my blood is drink indeed. He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him. So he kind of, for emphasis sake, he repeats this like four times. So then when he says the flesh is of no avail, the words I have spoken to you are spirit and life, spirit and truth. This is verse 63. It is the spirit that gives life. The flesh is of no avail. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and life. Okay. It doesn't mean that everything he just said before that suddenly is now falsified. Because after all, consider that Jesus in his flesh, his body, he was nailed to the cross. He shed his blood and he died. So if the Protestant wants to say that John 6:63, the flesh is of no avail, like the literal flesh and blood of Jesus is no avail, well, then that cancels out, that nullifies the crucifixion, which is absurd. Obviously, Jesus in his body, literally, body, blood, soul, and divinity, is the only thing that avails. And this whole misunderstanding, if the Protestant's making this argument, it hinges upon the word flesh. And that's the problem, because flesh, sarx, is the word in Greek. It can mean your actual body. I mean, it certainly could mean that, and very often in Scripture it does, your physical body. But we can prove that this doesn't mean that Jesus' physical body is of no avail, because if that were true, then his crucifixion and death on the cross is meaningless. And of course it's not. But very often this term sarx is used as a synonym for a carnal, and that word carnal, by the way, comes from the Latin word for meat, flesh. It means a fleshly, a carnal, a worldly, a non-spiritual mindset. Somebody who is thinking carnally, thinking about food and sex and stuff and worldly things. The word sarx is used throughout Scripture very often to mean that, and that's what it means in this context. So when Jesus says that the flesh is of no avail, he's saying basically, if you're thinking that I'm teaching you something that you're going to be able to just accept or not accept on the basis of your own worldly thoughts and your worldly opinions and not thinking in terms of what God is revealing to you right now, that's of no avail. You're never going to get it. It'll never make sense to you. And we see that some of these people, it didn't make sense for them, and they walked away from him. In verse 66, After this, many of his disciples drew back and no longer went about with him. Jesus said to the 12, "Do you also wish to go away?" Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life, and we have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God." Last little detail here, Jesus answered them, "Did I not choose you, the 12, and one of you is a devil?" He spoke of Judas, the son of Simon Iscariot, for he, one of the 12, was to betray him. And you'll note, this is just a little bit of a footnote here, you'll note that when Judas betrayed Jesus, it was at the Last Supper where he left to go hand Jesus over and betray him, and that was where the Holy Eucharist was instituted. So there's a linking here between the disbelief. It seems Judas himself was one of those who didn't believe. He links it in John chapter 6 with the Eucharist that was given at the Last Supper. So that's how I would respond to it, quite frankly, if somebody were to ask me that question, Christy, as many have over the years.
Okay. Thank you so much. I have a question on the Blessed Mother, but I'll call back another morning.
Okay. As you wish. I'll look forward to that next call. Thank you. Let's go to Jody now in Orlando. Hi, Jody.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller, and a huge admirer, Patrick.
Thank you. Thank you for all three.
So my question is, I inherited some religious medals, that, you know, like that you would wear around your neck, gold, from a deceased aunt. And I already have my own religious medals that I wear, so I don't really need any more. So would it be appropriate to sell these for the gold and to have the money perhaps given to a monastery or something that would say perpetual masses for the deceased in her honor, in her name?
That is certainly something you could do. What you could do, for example, is go to a local jeweler and ask him to melt these down. Are these actual gold medals?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So there is some value there. Yeah, you could have them melted down. And now the question is this. Sacramentals or things that have been blessed are not supposed to be sold. They're not supposed to be because of go back to the book of Acts. There was this magician called Simon Magus, that's the Latin word for magician. And he saw St. Peter and some of the other apostles performing miracles, and he wanted in on that action. So he offered them money. How much would it cost me for you to teach me these tricks? And so the apostle Peter, he says, forget about it. We're not going to sell this to you. We can't sell this to you in any case. And he rebuked him for this. But that led to a recognition of what's known as simony, which is the buying and the selling of sacred things. That could include the sacraments, for example. So it's a serious sin. And so the church says that you can't sell a blessed object, so a rosary or something like that. This is where there's a bit of a gray area here. So if you wanted to make a donation, let's say, to a perpetual mass association, one thing you could do is, if you contact the monastery, you could say, I have melted down into a gold bar or what have you, the gold that was from my relative's medals that were blessed. And I can't sell it, but I would like to donate this to you. And I would ask that you would, assign some value to that. And then would you celebrate X number of masses or the perpetual masses if I can enroll this relative in your program? They very well may say, sure, we can do that. You don't have to worry about it.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And could you recommend such a place? Because I know there's many. I just wondered if there was any that you would recommend.
Well, that's a question I don't think I have an answer for, because I don't know off the top of my head. I know that many religious orders, Carmelites, Dominicans, and others, they do have certain programs like that. And religious sisters in convents who have perpetual adoration do. But I just, off the top of my head, I don't know. I have a feeling, Jody, with a little bit of Googling, Catholic religious orders, perpetual masses, that kind of thing, you could easily find some. And you might want to stick with some that are known and proven to be good, solid orders. So take, for example, the Dominican Friars of the Eastern Province. This is where I live, in their province. So it's the province of St. Joseph. And their headquarters is in New York, and they are throughout the eastern states up to, say, Ohio. And their group, very solid, very orthodox, and I wouldn't be surprised if they had something like this if you were to just Google for them and check out their website.
Very good.
Okay.
Okay, well, that sounds good. So pretty much any order would do this.
Well, that I don't know. That I don't know.
Oh, okay.
It may not be the case for some orders, but I'm sure there are others who would. Yeah, so that would be something to investigate, but I don't think it'd be difficult.
Okay. Super. Well, then you've really helped me a lot. I wasn't expecting that, so I appreciate all your help.
I'm glad, Jody. Thank you, and I appreciate the phone call very much. 888-914-9149. How about Mike now? Lynn, where is Mike? California. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well, thanks.
I heard you talking about Mexico, and I lived there for several years. I speak the language very well. I am a Catholic, raised in an Italian-Portuguese neighborhood many years ago in the outside of San Jose Bay Area, at that time prior to Silicon Valley, so I understand culture and respect. You know, when I went to Mexico, I fell in love with the people and the culture. It's a very huge country, just like this country, with lots of diversity. What I did find when I was down there in 2009, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15 is a lot of Americans that I met, 50% of them were not on their best behavior. The majority of them came from Southern California with a self-entitlement attitude on vacation, thinking that they were better and they could do what they wanted to do. And some of the New Yorkers I met were a little brash and thought they were more Italian than me, which I found funny because I've been through the old country. My parents come from the old country. We speak the language.
Let me interject, Mike, if you don't mind. So, okay, I don't doubt your experience. I don't doubt it a bit. My mom and dad lived in Mexico City for 4 or 5 years. So I know what you're talking about, but what about that?
Well, I found the people to be warm and friendly. I found the Americans not to be overall on their best behavior. It's a big country, a lot of diversity.
I understand
that. I was in Guadalajara. Yeah.
I understand all that.
I found them to be devoted to family. And
Mike, I'm half Mexican. My family comes from Mexico, and I've spent a lot of time there myself. So I'm not doubting what you're saying, and I agree with you. But what about that?
Sure. Well, I found that there is prejudice wherever you go in the world. And what I did find, just like Italy, is that the young generation doesn't go to church like they used to.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, I don't disagree with any of it, but I thought you were talking about the LA Times article that I was referring to, in which the people who are quoted in the article are ticked off down in Mexico City because all these Americans are coming in. Now, it didn't say anything about bad behavior or being, you know, gauche or anything like that. It's just that they resented the fact that all these Americans are flooding in like a plague, one of them said, and they're coming in and they're jacking up the rents because they can pay higher prices and such. That's what I was referring to, but I'm not sure I make the connection with what you're saying here.
Well, look, they've been going down there for years. They're in Guanajuato, Puerto Vallarta. They're all over, but I've never seen Mexicans get upset, ticked off. They're an easygoing people. In fact, the entire time I was down there, I was never disrespected one time. And
do you
never called any nasty names? I gave them a lot of respect, and I received it.
Yeah.
And,
well, that's a good
so
way to be.
I don't think they're.
But so are the people who are quoted in the article lying? I mean, I'm not really sure what you're saying. This is a widespread phenomenon, apparently, widespread enough that the LA Times covered it. And a lot of these people are really unhappy because the Americans, not that the Americans are acting badly, but there are just too many Americans coming into that area, and it's upsetting the social and economic equilibrium, according to those people. Are they wrong?
They're wrong and they're right. The fact that their experience might be an isolated experience as opposed to my experience of living there every day for 7 years. I didn't see that. I'm not saying what they're saying is correct or incorrect, but they're in Mexico City. I was in Guadalajara, Puerto Vallarta, Manzanillo, Colima, Zacatecas.
I get it.
I didn't see any of that.
Right. Well, I don't dispute any of that, Mike. I'm sure you didn't, and I don't doubt it. But the fact that you didn't see it doesn't mean that it's not happening. And those people apparently are seeing it. And there's also, of course, this new phenomenon that probably didn't exist at that time when you were there, that you had a ton of Americans flooding into this area because of the rising prices in this country, the inflation, etc. Anyway, great talking to you, Mike. I'm sure you enjoy Taco Tuesday even more than most do. Thanks for the call. I want to share with you now something before we go to some more phone calls. This is what the church says on the issue of how to handle the remains of somebody, a Catholic, who dies. And in particular, what are you supposed to do or not do with their ashes? Now, the document is called Instruction Regarding the Burial of the Deceased and the Conservation of the Ashes in the Case of Cremation. So I want to read this to you so you have it straight from the horse's mouth. You know, we talk about on the program, what does the church say about can you disperse ashes? Can you spread them? Can you pour them in the ocean? What can you do with them? Can you keep them in an urn at your home? So rather than generalizing, I'd like to read to you what the church says in her own words. So when, and I'm going right to the heart of this issue, the church continues, it says, to prefer the practice of burying the bodies of the deceased because this shows a greater esteem toward the deceased. Nevertheless, cremation is not prohibited unless it was chosen for reasons contrary to Christian doctrine. Now, those reasons that would be considered contrary to Christian doctrine are spelled out in the Code of Canon Law, and that would include things like trying to deny the general resurrection, to in some way deny that God has the power to resurrect the body. That would be one example of that. But it continues. It says, in the absence of motives contrary to Christian doctrine, the church, after the celebration of the funeral rite, accompanies the choice of cremation, providing the relevant liturgical and pastoral directives, and taking particular care to avoid every form of scandal or the appearance of religious indifferentism. When for legitimate motives, cremation of the body has been chosen. Now listen closely here. The ashes of the faithful must be laid to rest in a sacred place, that is, in a cemetery or, in certain cases, in a church or an area which has been set aside for this purpose and so dedicated by the competent ecclesial authority. Now that is referring, even though they don't use the name there, the word that refers to like a columbarium, which is a place, typically it would be in a Catholic cemetery, where you would place the urn in a niche. There'd be typically it would be a plaque, the person's name, maybe the date of birth and death kind of thing. From the earliest times, Christians have desired that the faithful departed become the objects of the Christian community's prayers and remembrance. Their tombs have become places of prayer, remembrance, and reflection. The faithful departed remain part of the church who believes in the communion of all the faithful of Christ, those who are pilgrims on earth, the dead who are being purified, and the blessed in heaven, all together forming one church. The reservation of the ashes of the departed in a sacred place ensures that they are not excluded from the prayers and remembrances of their family or the Christian community. It prevents the faithful departed from being forgotten or their remains from being shown a lack of respect, which eventually is possible, most especially once the immediately subsequent generation has too passed away. Also, it prevents any unfitting or superstitious practices. For the reasons given above, the conservation of the ashes of the departed in a domestic residence is not permitted. Translation, you can't keep grandma's ashes on the mantelpiece in your home. It's not permitted. Only in grave and exceptional cases, dependent on cultural conditions of a localized nature, may the ordinary, that's your local bishop, in agreement with the Episcopal Conference or the Synod of Bishops, concede permission for the conservation of the ashes of the departed in a domestic residence. So if you, for some unusual reason, found that this would be the best way to go about it, or at least as you thought, you have to get permission from your bishop. You can't just do it. Continuing, nonetheless, the ashes may not be divided among various family members, and due respect must be maintained regarding the circumstance of such a conservation. Conservation means keeping it, like keeping it at home. In order that every appearance of pantheism, naturalism, or nihilism be avoided, it is not permitted to scatter the ashes of the faithful departed in the air, on land, at sea, or in some other way, nor may they be preserved in mementos, pieces of jewelry, or other objects. These courses of action cannot be legitimized by an appeal to the sanitary, social, or economic motives that may have occasioned the choice of cremation. When the deceased notoriously has requested cremation and the scattering of their ashes for reasons contrary to the faith, a Christian funeral must be denied to that person, according to the norms of canon law. So that is, as of 2016, when this was promulgated by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, that is coming straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak. That is the reason why you're not allowed to keep grandma's ashes. You're not allowed to scatter them. And I just wanted to give a chance so you could hear it in its purest form from the church. Now, a link to this document is going to be found on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show, excuse me. Or if you go to the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick, you'll find it there as well. We're going to take a break and I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic credit union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right. Karen in Albuquerque just sent me a note. Can I pray the rosary without the mysteries? Well, the answer is yes. I mean, praying the rosary is good in and of itself, but it's even better when you meditate upon the mysteries. So I would say you can, but it's better to meditate upon those mysteries. And they're there for a reason, is to really help you make the most out of and get the most spiritual benefit out of praying the rosary. But at the bare minimum, if you're praying the rosary in itself, that's a good thing. Thanks for the email. 888-914-9149. How about Marcy now in Phoenix? Good morning, Marcy.
Hi, Patrick. I was calling. My grandma passed away about 10 years ago. She was baptized Catholic, raised Catholic. She went to a Catholic school. She stopped practicing. She was not practicing. Okay. At the time of her death, it was her wish to be cremated. She was cremated. We scattered some of her ashes, and then the rest of her ashes were put into necklaces and gifted to her daughters and grandchildren, and I have one of those necklaces. I didn't realize I was just became Catholic. Went through their RCIA program a couple years ago.
Welcome home.
And I've had this necklace for, thank you so much. I've had this necklace for, 10 years, and I just realized, listening to your show, that that's wrong. So what should I do with it now that I have it?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, Marcy, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of people, after the fact, who are saying now, because they heard me read what the church says on this issue, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I shouldn't have done this. So here's my advice. Here's my advice. Take that necklace, and if you can get that, the same necklaces from the other people, I don't know if they'll give them to you, but if they will, then I would take them, or at the very least your own, and go to your local Catholic cemetery. If they have a columbarium, they'll certainly have a place for ashes. and get a niche where that can be placed in an urn or in some other container, and then have it placed there, even though that's not the totality of her remains. That's part of them. So you could, you could kind of, in a way, sort of repair by having that placed there. If you can get the other necklaces, so much the better. But it's not, you know, it's not as though what you're doing would somehow not be good if all the necklaces weren't gathered. But if you can, that'd be great. And then, because you didn't intend to do anything wrong, you didn't know that you were doing anything wrong, this is just a rule that the church has, I wouldn't let this bother you because you weren't intentionally committing a sin or anything. But if it does bother you,
to confess?
No, strictly speaking, no, because first of all, it's not something that you intended to do. You weren't aware of it, number one. You didn't intend to do anything wrong. And it happened, as I understand, before you became a Catholic. So were you baptized when you came into the Catholic Church, or had you been already baptized before that?
No, I was never baptized. I went through the RCIA program and was baptized for the first time. Catholic, received actually all my sacraments, including marriage, on the same day.
Wonderful. Wow, about a wonderful day, huh? And this issue with the scattering of the ashes and the necklaces and all that happened before this, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the reason I asked that question is that even if you had known, you know, I'm going to become a Catholic and I know the Catholic Church says not to do this, I'm going to do it anyway. Even if there were some type of formal sin on your part, that would have been obliterated by the sacrament of baptism in any case. So not only the sin, but the effects of sin, it would have been forgiven, and all the effects of sin would be obliterated when you were baptized. So for that reason alone, it's not something that you would need to confess, because your baptism took care of that. So don't let it weigh on your conscience. But I would say, if you can, get in touch with the diocesan department for cemeteries and find a cemetery where they've got a columbarium. And if you can, put the necklace there. That would be the best thing in my recommendation.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome, Marcy. Thank you. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Denise in St. John, Indiana. Hi, Denise.
Hi, Patrick. I'm like shaking in my boots here. I lost two brothers young, and both were the first in our families to be cremated. And my one brother, his children chose a White Sox urn, and that's on our bar under a big neon sign in memory of Uncle Mike. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I had no clue. And then the rest of his ashes, and this is the second question, were in a columbarium because he was in the service in the military cemetery in Illinois. Mm-hmm. Is it even okay to separate ashes? That's another thing that I just thought of this morning.
Yeah, well, let's answer that one first. It's not okay to separate the ashes. So in the document that I had read a little while ago, did you hear me read that document? Okay.
Yes, I've been listening all morning.
Okay, wonderful. So in that document, it does say that, among other things, that you can't divide up the ashes and have those spread around among family members. That, too, is not permitted. So, yeah, but you didn't know. You didn't know. And I think a lot of people, they just didn't know. It wasn't something that was ever on their radar screen. So my advice would be, you know, it's a sensitive subject, obviously, and people's emotions are involved here. But with all respect, my advice would be to take whatever ashes remain and have those brought to where his other ashes are buried, and have those put there with that, so that everything you have is there together in the grave. Would be my suggestion.
And the other brother actually, his wife took the ashes, and as the other lady said, she had them made into necklaces with his thumbprint, which our undertakers, you know, they're very close friends of ours. They told us that you could do that, and they all have them. And my nephew has a crucifix. My other niece has a crucifix with the ashes in it. And this is all news. And again, I'm not trying to be a critical Catholic, but, you know, some of these things are starting to bother me, that the church doesn't teach us a lot of this. You know, now that I know, I can sort of, I don't think most of them are going to agree, because even when my niece had her first little child, she has a picture of his little thumb on his grandpa's thumb print on the necklace. So this is so emotional, you know, and again, you're right. We don't know. I'm not questioning that it's sinful, but I just wish that, I know there's so many more important issues, but I just wish the church would really start reforming some of its teachings. Now, I teach religious ed, and now I feel that when people question me, I have an answer to give them, not my fourth graders, but sometimes their parents. But, you know, and again, I don't want to sound critical, but even with the Holy Eucharist, I'm in shock when I hear, well, I didn't know, it's not really his body and blood. You know, maybe because I was cradle Catholic and all the way through university.
You mean that they didn't know that it was Jesus's body, blood, soul, and divinity?
No, that it's a symbol. And I go, but he said, this is my body. He would have said, this is a symbol.
No, I get it. I get it. But the way you said it sounded like people said, I never knew that this wasn't his body. But I think I understand what you're saying. Well, you don't sound critical, Denise. You sound concerned, and that makes sense to me. Naturally, this is the kind of thing that you're not likely to hear preached on at Mass, because the priests are supposed to preach on the readings of the Mass that day, and there's no reading that I know of that talks about what to do with the ashes of somebody who was cremated. But in any case, I understand what you're saying. So we can rejoice in the fact that Relevant Radio is available for a vast audience of people, not just Catholics, and we can help disseminate this information and make it available, just like we did today, you know?
Well, thank God for Relevant Radio, because I would never, I don't know how I would have found that out, you know, and one more thing, we have a brand new pastor, and I just want to tell you this quickly. He is phenomenal. And at the end of Mass, he says a Hail Mary every single Mass and says, and please let us all pray for all the clerical victims, not clerical victims, but the victims of clerical abuse. And I've never had a pastor do that. So
that's
we're
great.
Just thrilled with him, you know.
I can see why.
That's all I had to say, but thank you. And I don't feel guilty. I just, as again, I thank you that I can now teach other people about this. So thank you so much, Patrick.
You're most welcome. Thank you. And I agree with you. Thank God for Relevant Radio. This is a way. See, and part of what we do, a big part of what we do, Denise, or at least we strive to assist the bishops and the priests, because they only have so much time. And at Mass, for example, 10 minutes for a homily can't cover a lot of ground just by virtue of the time. So we have 24 hours a day on Relevant Radio where we can help fill in the blanks and reinforce the things people do know and fill in the blanks for things that they don't know. Help them to get the bigger picture day by day by day. So I'm glad that we could do this today. And Cyrus, I don't see that you posted this yet on the show Twitter feed. I presume you're going to do so sometime soon?
Yes, English. Will you send me the link, please?
Oh, yeah. Happy to do that. And so that's going to be up on the show Twitter feed in, let's see. Well, now it's going to be on the show Twitter feed pretty quickly. And you'll find it there. If you don't use Twitter, don't worry. You can always go to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Be sure to put the /Patrick on that URL. Otherwise, it'll take you to the main page. Go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and you'll find the link there. Now, for those of you listening, if this has happened, you know, don't be distressed. If you didn't know, if you didn't realize, this is the church's law. This is what the church requires, and you didn't know. I don't want you to feel like, oh my gosh, I committed this sin, because even though technically doing it would be wrong, I guess you could say, if you didn't know, you are not culpable of committing a sin because you didn't know. You were completely blissfully unaware. But now that you are aware, my advice would be take steps to try to repair this situation, to fix it. And the easiest way to do it would be read this document, and you'll be able to get it in just a moment on the show Twitter feed. If need be, maybe send a link to your family members who have grandma's ashes in their necklaces or some other jewelry, or maybe on the mantelpiece. Just share it with them and just say, you know, I recently became aware of what the church requires on this issue, and I thought you'd like to know also, so that maybe as a family, we can fix the situation and do what the church is asking of us to do. None of us knew. We didn't realize it. But now that we do, let's take some steps to fix the situation. And you can let the church do the talking by sharing this brief document with them. And there's much more to it that I didn't quote for you, in which the church explains, even quoting the Bible, why it has this rule. It's not merely, well, here's just a rule because the church gives a rationale for that rule in this document. And you can read it for yourself. I think you'll find it very instructive and also very comforting as well. 888-914-9149. We're going to take a break, but we'll be right back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right, a little Duran Duran in the morning. That's a good thing. 888-914-9149. Have an email from Steve, listening in Presque Isle, Maine. Thank you, Steve, for writing to me. He says, stop the emails. Live callers are your bread and butter. This is my first and last email to Patrick Madrid. I will continue to listen to your shows that contain mostly live callers. Well, you're in luck, Steve, because if you had decided not to listen to my shows where I read emails, you wouldn't have heard your email read. And see how nice it feels? A lot of people can't call in for whatever reason, but they can email me, and I like to try to answer questions as best I can. Here's an email that comes in from Grace. Steve, I hope you can bear with me on this. Grace in Austin, Texas says, Patrick, is it possible for a marriage to be annulled when the couple have conceived children? And if it is, does that bastardize those children? Well, strictly speaking, if it's a valid marriage, the church, of course, cannot annul that. But rather, what the church does in the annulment process is determine whether or not what was presumed to be a marriage was valid or invalid. That's what the process is intended to do. And if the church makes a declaration of nullity, it means that it was null from the beginning, meaning that it was never valid. Now, what about the children? It has nothing whatsoever to do with the legitimacy or illegitimacy of the children. And this is a common misconception. So I don't blame you for not knowing that answer. A lot of Catholics don't know that answer. They wonder, oh my gosh, if we get an annulment, does that mean that our children are illegitimate? Absolutely not. That's a category under the civil law. And so the Catholic Church does not in any way say or even suggest, because it's not true, that somehow those children are illegitimate if it turns out that the marriage was null from the beginning because of some impediment. So hopefully that puts your mind at ease. This comes from Ruth in Lexington, Kentucky. Actually, I'm going to save Ruth's email for a little bit later. It's a little bit longer. This one comes in from Michael, listening in Philadelphia, who says, I'm just writing in to say that I have been experiencing what that woman who called into the program a week or so ago is struggling with. Recently, he says, I have been drinking too much alcohol, and it seems that the more I pray to stop, the more I drink. She has provided me an answer to my problem. Just wanted to thank you for getting her on the phone to talk. It really helped me. Now I have a path of help. Yeah, I remember that phone call. And I think, as I recall, I mentioned to her that the prayer is not the problem. Praying, you can't pray too much, but it may be something that requires more than just prayer. And so if anyone is interested in that phone call, you'll find it on the show archives. Just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick and go back maybe 10 days or so, and you'll find that particular call. This one comes in from Steve in St. Petersburg, Florida. It says, my wife and I are questioning whether or not we should do business with companies who pay their employees to cross state lines to get an abortion. There are several. Actually, there are many. He names a few: Amazon, Bank of America, Citigroup, CVS, Chase, etc. We don't believe in this, nor do we support these types of policies. So if we buy things from these companies and do business with them, are we supporting these policies? Do we have to look at all the companies we buy things from to see what their policies are? It seems like that would be a daunting task. Indeed, it would be. And I think largely, Steve, because there are so many companies that in one way or another, this is just one of those ways, one way or another, they try to support big abortion. So it would be daunting. But to answer your question as best I can, if you can avoid doing business with an organization that does socially irresponsible things like that, then I would say so much the better. And if you can avoid it, then you should avoid it. But in some cases, it's unavoidable. And because of these tentacles that go through so many different companies, you can't buy a battery to put in an electronics item in your home. You can't get on an airplane. You can't shop for food. You can't. You know what I'm saying? It's just like it's so spread everywhere that it would become difficult to the point of impossible to completely avoid it. And I think the underlying question here is, are you committing a sin by saying, well, I know that CVS does this, but I really need some aspirin. I've got a sick child. I've got to get some, well, they don't give the kid aspirin. I need some children's Tylenol and I need to get it now. And there's a CVS down the street. You're not committing a sin if you buy children's Tylenol at CVS, knowing that CVS is in some way or another involved with that, because you're not intending to support the abortion. You're not intending that, and it's out of your control. Now, you may say, well, I could drive 5 miles further and go to a Walgreens, and I don't know if Walgreens does things like this. Let's say they don't. I don't know. But let's just say they don't. Well, then you're faced with a question of, you know, do you want to go that extra 5 miles to purchase a product at a store where you know that they don't do this? I would say if you can do that, do that. But if the only way that you can get the children's Tylenol for your sick child is to go to CVS, I would go to CVS. And I wouldn't scruple over the fact that you're spending your $5 or $10 on this medicine for your child, because you're remote enough from this evil that you're not really involved in it. If you become more involved in it by being closer to the problem itself. So let's say it's not that you're going to CVS to buy some children's Tylenol. Let's say that you're on the board of directors of CVS and you vote in the quarterly board meeting, hey, let's send some of our money to Planned Parenthood. Well, then you're definitely involved, because you had a hand in this policy of CVS diverting some of its money to big abortion. Well, yeah, you're definitely at that point involved. So that would be much closer to the evil itself, and you would have had some role to play in that. But to buy some children's Tylenol from CVS because you need to, no, you're not committing a sin. I hope I'm not over-explaining it, but this is an important question that you're raising. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Mary in Jersey City, New Jersey. Hi, Mary. Welcome.
Hi, Mr. Madrid. God bless you.
Thank you.
My question to you is, I went to Mass last week, this not this week, but the week prior, and it was the gospel with Mary Magdalene, mm-hmm. and this priest is a good priest. I don't want to say anything bad about any priest. God love them all. But he's very liberal. And I never heard this before, so I was pretty perplexed. He said that Mary Magdalene, how many people, he asked the congregation, how many people believed that Mary Magdalene was a prostitute? I would say about a third raised their hands, others just didn't. But he said that that's a fallacy, that Mary Magdalene was not a prostitute, and that so after Mass, he came up with this thing like 500 years ago. I can't really remember the details of it, however. But he said that after Mass, I said to him, well, then why did the Lord say to her, go and sin no more? He goes, no, he didn't say it to her. He said it to the other woman that was there.
I think I can help.
There's no.
Mary, I think I can
okay,
help you.
Thank you.
Okay, sure. Now, as a point of technicality, it is true. The woman who is caught in adultery, who's not named, by the way, is the one to whom Jesus said, go and sin no more. But that doesn't change the bigger picture about what the church teaches about Mary Magdalene. So what I'd like to do is read to you the pertinent section on this issue from the Catholic Encyclopedia. And I'm just going to read it verbatim and give you all of it. so you can see what it says. In the New Testament, Mary Magdalene is mentioned among the women who accompanied Christ and ministered to him, Luke chapter 8, verses 2 through 3, where it is also said that seven devils had been cast out of her, Mark 16, verse 9. She is next named as standing at the foot of the cross, and this is in Mark 15, Matthew 27, John 19, and Luke 23. She saw Christ laid in the tomb, and she was the first recorded witness of the resurrection. The Greek fathers, as a whole, distinguish three persons. One is the sinner in Luke 7. The other is the sister of Martha and Lazarus, that's in Luke 10 and John 11, and Mary Magdalene. On the other hand, the encyclopedia says, most of the Latins, that would be Latin Rite Catholics most importantly, hold that these three were one and the same person. Some Protestant critics believe there were two, if not three, distinct persons. It is not impossible to demonstrate the identity of the three, but those commentators undoubtedly go too far when they assert that these are three different people. So now what the encyclopedia does is give the reasons for holding that they're one and the same person. It says, the harmonizing tendencies of so many modern critics are responsible for much of the existing confusion. The first fact mentioned in the gospel relating to the question under discussion is the anointing of Christ's feet by a woman, a sinner, in the city, Luke 7, verses 37 through 50. This belongs to the Galilean ministry. It precedes the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000 and the third Passover. Immediately afterwards, St. Luke describes a missionary circuit in Galilee and tells us of the women who ministered to Christ, among them being Mary, who is called Magdalene, out of whom seven devils were gone forth. That's Luke 8, 2. But he does not tell us that she is to be identified with the sinner of the previous chapter. In chapter 10, verses 38 through 42, he tells us of Christ's visit to Martha and Mary in a certain town. It is impossible to identify this town, but it is clear from chapter 9, verse 53, that Christ had definitively left Galilee, and it is quite possible that this town, mentioned obliquely, was Bethany. This seems confirmed by the preceding parable of the Good Samaritan, which must also certainly have been spoken on the road between Jericho and Jerusalem. But here again, we note that there is no suggestion of an identification of the three persons, the sinner, Mary Magdalene, and Mary of Bethany. And if we only had only St. Luke to guide us, we should certainly have no grounds for so identifying them. This is a rather clunky way of saying there's no biblical reason to assume that these are three different people. St. John clearly identifies Mary of Bethany with the woman who anointed Christ's feet. That's in chapter 12 of John's Gospel. Also Matthew chapter 26 and Mark chapter 14. It is remarkable that already in chapter 12, verse 2 of St. John's Gospel, St. John has spoken of Mary as she that anointed the Lord's feet. It is commonly said that he refers to the subsequent anointing, which he himself describes in chapter 12, verses 3 through 8, but it may be questioned whether he would have used, and they give a Greek phrase there, if another woman, and she a sinner, in the city had done the same. So in other words, it's calling into question the possibility that St. John might have been describing two different women. It is conceivable that St. John, just because he is writing so, that he might have done it, and they say also in the same way St. Luke may have veiled her identity precisely because he did not wish to defame one who was yet living. He certainly does something similar in the case of Matthew, whose identity with Levi the publican he conceals. So here they're referring to if indeed Mary Magdalene was this former prostitute, that maybe St. John was trying to be discreet by not mentioning her name so as not to cause her any pain because of her notorious past. And he's making a comparison here with how St. Luke deals with St. Matthew. He doesn't refer to him by his name Matthew, but rather Levi, which was, you know, a different name for him. And that's because of his sordid past as being a tax collector, which was a wicked profession because it was a form, it involved extorting money from people above and beyond what the Romans required. Anyway, if the foregoing argument holds good, Mary of Bethany and the sinner are one and the same. An examination of St. John's Gospel makes it almost impossible to deny the identity of Mary of Bethany with Mary Magdalene, from St. John, we learn that the name of the woman who anointed Christ's feet prior to the Last Supper, and we may remark here that it seems unnecessary to hold that because St. Matthew and St. Mark say 2 days before the Passover, while St. John says 6 days, that there were therefore two distinct anointings following one another. St. John does not necessarily mean that the supper and the anointing took place 6 days before, but only that Christ came to Bethany 6 days before the Passover. So you can see that there's a really precise biblical chronology here, and it's showing, and I could read more, but the essence of the whole thing is that indeed Mary Magdalene is this woman, this one and the same woman who is described in various ways, sometimes with her name, sometimes just as Mary, and sometimes just as a woman and not giving her name. So if you're interested, we'll get a link to this article, and it's longer than I'll have an opportunity to read to you verbatim on the show, but it will walk you through every single verse in which she appears and make the case that this is one and the same person. So my advice would be to go with that. That seems to make the most sense biblically. And sometimes people hold different views. I've heard this view before that Mary Magdalene wasn't that woman. I don't think it pans out biblically, as this article shows, but I think you'll find that helpful. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate that. I think we have to take a break because I think
man's
I've heard
got
it said.
To know his limitations.
That's what I thought. And it wouldn't be prudent at this juncture.
Wouldn't be prudent at this juncture.
Not going to do it.
Not going to do it.
Me either. All right, we'll take a break. 2 minutes. I'm not going to say if you got them, smoke them, because I don't think smoking is good. But refill your coffee cup. I'll be right back right after this.
I got a fever, and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on.